From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, November 8th, 2017. And on this day, what's next for Medicaid expansion in Maine after voters overwhelmingly approved it yesterday? Anthony Sanborn is a free man after almost 30 years in prison, and we'll have that and much more ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, presenting Gardens Aglow, where visitors will see the gardens in a whole new light. Tickets available at MaineGardens.org.
First tonight, sentenced to 70 years in prison for the 1989 killing of a 16-year-old girl in Portland, Anthony Sanborn is a free man. In the wake of a key witness's recantation, prosecutors agreed today that the sentence amounted to cruel and unusual punishment and to reduce it to time served. And as Fred Bever reports, Sanborn maintains his innocence.
The deal capped 21 days of post-conviction review in Cumberland County Superior Court. Sanborn's lawyers won the review after they alleged that key witnesses may have been coerced and evidence withheld in his trial for the murder of 16-year-old Jessica Briggs on Portland's waterfront. Amy Fairfield, his lawyer and champion this past year, told the court that he would accept the time-served option prosecutors presented Tuesday afternoon. But she made another point, too.
It's a closed case. He does understand that. But as we state in his amended petition, he vehemently and steadfastly maintains his innocence in this case.
Tears and hugs broke out among Sanborn's friends and family, and then Sanborn asked for a moment to thank Justice Joyce Wheeler for her integrity.
To have the guts to do what you did, and I don't know where your stance is or what you believe, and I know this at this stage, and you can't tell me, but thank you for being someone that, because I didn't believe in anything in the system, so... Thank you.
Thank you. I understand you've lost your faith in the justice system, and my only goal is to ensure justice is done and to give everyone a fair hearing, fair trial. And I hope that you leave here with that conviction today.
In an apparent concession that the original 70-year sentence was not just, the plea deal included an unusual statement from prosecutors that in light of U.S. case law, Sanborn's original sentence amounted to cruel and unusual punishment. But outside the courthouse, Assistant Attorney General Meg Gillam insisted he was a murderer.
Mr. Sanborn remains today, as he was after the jury's verdict in 1992, guilty of the murder of Jessica Briggs, because Mr. Sanborn chose to withdraw his claims after hearing the testimony of the witnesses in this hearing.
The victim's stepmother, Susan Briggs, told reporters she was satisfied with the outcome because Sanborn remained a convicted murderer in the eyes of the law. Sanborn's defense attorney, Amy Fairfield, doesn't see it that way. She says she would have liked to reject the prosecution's deal and continue the case.
The moment you met him, it was just, you got to get him out. And so what followed certainly wasn't exactly what I wanted to see happen. But again, you know, I'm just so elated for him. He deserves to be happy and to be free.
In the end, she said Sanborn, now 47, was exhausted and just wanted to live his life. Fairfield and her co-counsel said they and their client were not yet ready to consider whether they might seek redress or compensation through a lawsuit against the state. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
The ballot campaign to expand Medicaid is over, and voters overwhelmingly said yes. Now advocates of Medicaid expansion say they'll get working to make sure the roughly 70,000 low-income Mainers who qualify actually receive the health coverage. Republican Governor Paula Page is threatening to block implementation of the expansion. As Steve Missler reports, the governor's move was expected, but it sets the stage for yet another battle over Medicaid in the legislature.
Robin Merrill, the executive director of Maine Equal Justice Partners, has been battling Governor LePage over the expansion of Medicaid through the Affordable Care Act for over 4 years. And on election night, Merrill and supporters of Question 2 finally delivered a resounding blow to the governor's strident and successful opposition to expand eligibility of the taxpayer-funded health program. They went directly to voters.
We did it! We really did it!
The victory at the ballot box was historic and potentially a roadmap for the 18 other GOP-controlled states that have refused to expand Medicaid under the ACA. But LePage isn't accepting defeat.
Give me the money, and I will enforce the referendum.
In a brief interview with Maine Public Radio, LePage reiterated what he said in a written statement less than 10 hours after Question 2 was ratified by voters. He won't implement Medicaid expansion until the legislature appropriates funds to pay for the state's share of the program.
As soon as the legislature gives me the funds, I will enforce the law, the referendum. But without money, there's nothing I can do.
The governor says implementation requires state money. The feds, who will pay for 94% for the first 2 years of the expanded program, will pay over $500 million annually. But LePage says he won't initiate the rulemaking process to trigger the release of federal funds until the legislature passes a new spending bill to pay for the state share. That's roughly $55 million a year, according to an analysis by the legislature's nonpartisan budget office. But Robin Merrill with Maine Equal Justice Partners says the governor doesn't have a choice.
The bill that people passed yesterday requires the governor and this administration to implement the law and to provide coverage to over 70,000 people. It's incredibly urgent, and people have waited long enough, and this is going to happen.
In other words, the law is the law. And Merrill says her organization will do whatever is required to make sure the administration adheres to it. That includes legal action, if necessary.
This is the law of the land. The people passed this yesterday. It will become effective 45 days after the legislature convenes.
But while a court battle may loom in the distance, the political fight is already underway. Democratic House Speaker Sarah Gideon and Senate Minority Leader Troy Jackson both released statements Wednesday blasting the governor for threatening to block the will of voters. Meanwhile, House Republican leader Ken Fredette of Newport once again aligned with the governor. Fredette's caucus has outsized influence in a legislature divided between the Democratic-controlled House and the Republican-led Senate. That's because circumventing LePage often requires a two-thirds vote in both chambers. That's how Fredette and House Republicans blocked a bipartisan budget deal and shut down state government last summer. And it appears LePage and House Republicans are preparing for a similar standoff over Medicaid expansion. LePage was asked Wednesday if he'll veto any bill that attempts to fund Medicaid expansion with tax revenues.
That is correct.
The administration and DHHS have an obligation within some very strict time frames to move forward with everything that they need to do to implement this.
Westbrook Representative Drew Gatine is the Democratic lead on the legislature's budget writing committee. He reiterated Merrill's point that the administration should adhere to the voter-approved law and that he hopes Republicans will help fund the state's share. But Gatine also says the legislature doesn't need to get into a big budget fight to implement expansion.
The vast majority of money that's going to need to come from the state actually comes when we start paying claims. The state share is obligated on a claim-by-claim basis.
In other words, Gatine says the legislature doesn't need to find $55 million to fund Medicaid expansion right away. After all, the federal money isn't required to roll in until 180 days after the law takes effect in March. That means people eligible for Medicaid under expansion won't likely receive benefits until next summer, even if everyone in Augusta agreed to implement the law as voters intended. But given the governor's immediate declaration to halt expansion, it's possible the 70,000 Mainers who will soon qualify for Medicaid will have to continue to wait to receive health coverage. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Maine voters did vote overwhelmingly to expand Medicaid, but how long will it be before the 70,000 or so Mainers who qualify are covered? As we just heard, it could be months. Mal Leary joins me from our Statehouse Bureau now to explain why. Mal, I think when people heard the news that the referendum had passed, many thought coverage would start shortly. Why is it going to take so long?
Well, first of all, Nora, everything in government takes longer than you expect, and this certainly will be no exception. Under the state constitution, the referendum becomes effective 45 days after the legislature reconvenes January 3rd. That's to give the legislature time to fund the expansion. It's there for any bill that has a price tag on it. And right there, we see the first potential slowdown in the implementation. The governor said very clearly he'll veto a tax increase or taking the money out of the rainy day fund, which are the two easiest ways to come up with the money to pay for this. So therefore, we're going to immediately have this sort of gridlock between the governor and the legislature, where most will support expansion as they have in the past. But it's likely the House Republicans will continue to support him and block the money from either one of those easy sources.
So even if the majority of the legislature passed a bill that funded expansion, that's not enough. The governor can still block it.
Governor can still block it because, unlike what people believe, the citizen initiative process simply passes a law just like any law the legislature enacts, so it can be changed. The petition that voters can force a vote on a proposal, but once that proposal has been adopted, it's like any other law that's before the legislature. They can change it. They can modify it. And remember, we saw earlier this year the outright repeal of the surtax to pay for schools that the voters had approved at referendum just a few months previously. So without funding, the expansion program, the expansion of Medicaid, is really dead in the water, because most of Medicaid is paid for by the federal government, and they'll require that the state fund their share of the program at some point down the road.
Okay, so let's just say that the legislature does come up with the funding in the spring. Will people then be able to get the coverage that voters approved?
I wish it were that simple, but of course it isn't. This is a joint federal-state program. The expansion and implementation must be approved by the federal government, and that's a process that takes months to begin with. The voter-approved bill itself says coverage should start about 6 months after the law is effective. So we're looking at a best case of late summer before that 80,000 or so Mainers get coverage, and of course, it could be longer. The federal government will not approve an expansion that does not provide the state share of the cost. And remember, it took a state government shutdown over the 4th of July weekend a few months ago to get a two-year state budget passed, so lawmakers could put off the law until the new governor and legislature take office a year from January, hoping there will be, well, shall we say, less gridlock and more cooperation between the new governor and legislature.
Okay, one more question, Mel. It's my understanding that people in all areas of the state voted to expand Medicaid. Is there not a political cost to Republican politicians in the state house to allowing it to get held up?
Well, there could be a political cost, as you point out, from the rejection of what the voters passed a year ago, and that is additional money for schools. There could be backlash on them going in and changing the tip credit on the minimum wage bill. There's always that possibility of a backlash. But you got to remember, a lot of these folks are also term limited, so they're not going to have to worry about the voters. They're just voting with their governor.
Okay, thank you, Mel.
Thank you, Nora.
And speaking of referendum questions, supporters of ranked choice voting were back at the polls yesterday, just one day after Maine's Secretary of State approved their petitions for a people's veto of a law that delays implementation of ranked choice voting until 2021. Kyle Bailey is the manager of that campaign.
We have 90 days to collect 61,123 valid signatures. Upon submitting those signatures, we freeze the law in place as it was approved by voters in November of 2016.
Last November, Maine voters became the first in the nation to authorize a system where voters rank candidates in order of their preference. But after the Maine Supreme Court issued an advisory opinion saying part of that law was unconstitutional, Maine lawmakers recently opted to delay its start. Bailey says Mainers have made it clear they don't want to wait, and on Election Day, about 400 volunteers fanned out to the polls to try and prove that.
The people's veto restores ranked choice voting for the 7 elections that are unaffected by the court's non-binding advisory opinion on ranked choice voting. So voters will have a chance to restore ranked choice voting for use in the primary elections and the federal elections, for which there are no constitutional questions about using ranked choice voting.
Bailey says people want a chance to claim more voice and more choice in their democracy. Many, he says, expressed frustration with the legislature for overturning the will of the people. If they're successful with the people's veto, voters will have a chance to decide to keep ranked choice voting in June and also get the chance to rank the candidates for governor and Congress in primary elections. This year's high school freshmen in Maine will be the first in the country to graduate with a new kind of diploma. Instead of amassing a set number of credits, they'll need to show that they are proficient and meet certain standards. It's a change that's been nearly a decade in the making. But as Robbie Feinberg reports, some educators are still worried about what it will mean for students and for teachers.
I've moved up 6 spaces, and there I am at -2.
So negative to the left, positive to the right.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Mozart Olivera scribbles furiously on a packet of math problems at Spruce Mountain Adult Education, a brick building along the banks of the Androscoggin River in Livermore Falls. With a small calculator and a folder chock full of practice problems, Olivera listens intently to his teacher, Betsy Bremner. They start with fractions, then work their way up to negative numbers. But for Olivera, who's been out of high school for more than a decade, it's been a struggle to catch up.
It's been so long.
It's okay. Think of money. Spending.
All right, so you're saying I have $10, take away one. Is that what you're saying?
I'm spending $1. I'm going and spending another $10 today. I've been out.
3 years ago, Olivera arrived at Spruce Mountain without a high school degree. But he began taking classes and passed his high school equivalency exam, called the HiSET. Now he wants to go to college, too, to support his 3 kids with a more reliable job.
I remember one shift I would work from, 3 to, 5 in the morning. You kind of get sick of that because it's like, you know, what's the point of destroying my body when I could just use my brain and do something I like and have a good career and enjoy doing so. So after I had that contemplation with myself, I was like, I'm just going to do it.
But as Olivera labors over these math problems, he's finding he has to know a lot more in order to advance. If he's not prepared, he may end up in remedial math and English classes, which often don't count for college credit. And Central Maine Community College President Scott Knapp says with that obstacle in the way, some students may become discouraged and drop out.
Because we know with some of those students, they're just going to turn their back on it. And you say, no, that's not what I wanted.
And remedial courses aren't limited to adult students like Olivera. In fact, more than 10% of students who head to Maine's public universities from high school end up taking them. For community college students, it's more than 40%. Ed Servone, the executive director of the business-led education group Educate Maine, says the statistics point to a problem.
When we looked at a combination of test scores, remediation rates at higher ed institutions, and from reports from employers, it was clear that all that were being graduated weren't quite ready.
The proposed solution in 2011, says former State Education Commissioner Stephen Bowen, was to develop new requirements to graduate by simply compiling enough seat time and core school subjects, as in 4 math classes, 4 English classes, and so on. Bowen says students were leaving high school with large gaps in what they knew. But he says a proficiency-based diploma would fix that problem.
As opposed to kids have to sit in a seat in an algebra class for a full year and pass the algebra class. And because they passed the algebra class and because they passed their other classes, we're now going to say they're ready to get a high school diploma. So that was what the change was.
Under the new system, schools would determine what a graduating student should know, and then students would have to demonstrate that they actually know it. The state had already created a set of these standards back in 1997 called the Maine Learning Results. But back then, they were mostly designed as a tool for teachers and administrators and weren't specifically tied to graduation. And then in 2009, the State Department of Education offered trainings to 9 school districts in customized learning, which used proficiency-based education. Within 2 years, Commissioner Bowen and another state official, Don Savisky, were pushing the idea across the state, talking at conferences and mailing out books about proficiency-based education to every Maine superintendent. Savisky says he would tell officials that with so many students rated as not proficient on standardized tests, schools had a moral imperative to embrace this new approach.
So my personal mantra is, all kids can learn to high levels. Learning is messy. Every kid has got a different pathway. And it's up to us as a smart person to try to figure that pathway out and help kids find success.
At first, it was a tough sell for some lawmakers. Justin Alfond, the co-chair of the legislature's education committee at the time, says he was initially skeptical of the proficiency-based diploma bill. but visits to classrooms like one in the Grey New Gloucester School District, where young students worked in teams and solved problems together, brought him around.
You could see the excitement and joy of accomplishing something. It was just something that made me say, like, this is happening. This isn't just theory. Like, children, students are doing this right now, and I got to watch it all unfold.
Ultimately, in 2012, other lawmakers came on board, and the law passed by a wide majority. Maine became the first state in the country to require students to graduate based on competency rather than on credits. Other states like Colorado and Vermont have since passed similar laws. But in Maine, implementing the law has proven harder than many anticipated. Maine Education Association President Lois Kilby Chesley says her organization still has concerns about the effects on special education and teacher workloads. She says recent turnover within the Department of Education has not provided reassurance.
You know, you get an answer from one person and then that person's not there anymore, so you go to the next person and so... a lot of the questions are the same.
In September, the department withdrew new rulemaking for parts of the law because of continued concerns from educators around similar issues. But some school districts are already fully proficiency-based, while others are still just getting off the ground. And state proficiency-based education specialist Diana Duiron says Maine plans to stay the course.
We have to take these first steps if we want to continue to grow. We can't figure this all out in our heads because it involves human beings. And human beings are dynamic individuals and no two of us are alike. And it's in this work together that we'll get there over time. And we need to be patient with one another as we get there.
And despite the rocky start, many educators still say they're excited about the promise of proficiency-based education and have embraced new practices that they say are improving schools across the state. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And we'll be reporting about new education trends by looking at one rural Maine school district over the course of the year. It's a series we're calling Lessons from Oak Hill. Be listening for the first story later this week. In the interest of full disclosure, the Maine Education Association represents most of Maine Public's news staff. Education reporting on Maine Public Radio is supported by a grant from the Nellie Mae Education Foundation. For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Wednesday, November 8th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.